This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
I'm Wang Xiaoning, and this is the Breakfast Grill. There is a Chinese saying that on one mountain there cannot be two tigers, and that phrase rings so true today when we look at the current state of US-China relations. So to help us dissect this relationship, and also very importantly, China's growing position as a global economic and political superpower, we have David Dollar, Senior Fellow at Brookings Institute and co-author of a recently published book, China 2049, Economic Challenges of a Rising Global Power. Thank you for joining us this morning, David.
Yeah, happy to talk to you.
I want to start with COVID-19, and you've been a very long-time observer of China. Do you think that this pandemic will dramatically change their current economic policy or just perhaps delay their centennial goals, in particular, the one to be a developed country by 2049?
The COVID-19, the pandemic and the recession is certainly affecting China's targets for 2020. They're actually looking pretty good compared to most of the rest of the world. They will turn in positive growth for 2020, but it won't be as strong as in recent years. So they'll fall short a little bit of their 2020 goal. But in general, they're bouncing back pretty well. And I don't think the virus, the recession, will have much effect on longer term goals like 2030 or 2049. If anything, it may galvanize them to reform more quickly, and that will help them meet those 2049 goals.
Okay, we're going to come back to the reform portion of the discussion. But I also want to know whether COVID-19 exposes certain flaws and challenges that the Chinese economy faces. I think we kind of established that, China is a growing economy. But some of the hurdles I see is in that move towards an innovation-driven economy to become a fully developed one. So, recently we've actually seen, especially with Xi Jinping coming to power, he has centralized a lot of control and there's much less liberalization. Do you think that impacts education and the necessity? I mean, you do need that human capital, right, to be that innovative economy.
I think for China to become a more innovative economy, they definitely need more freedom in their education system, which we don't see. They need stronger intellectual property rights protection. That we actually do see. I think they're gradually improving IPR. They need reforms in their financial system. So I don't see that they've backtracked on economic reform, but there are those issues of freedom in the universities, freedom of speech and the internet. All of that is supportive of innovation. So I see them having strengths in some areas and weaknesses in other areas in terms of really generating innovation.
And then when we look at China also, they've successfully adopted a dual reform strategy with this almost asymmetric liberalization, which I think really worked very well in the 1990s and the 2000s. But at the same time, it does have this inefficient policy distortion, especially in the finance sector. So, when you were talking about the necessity for reform, do you see this pandemic expose that requirement in the financial sector?
Yes, absolutely. I think one of the legacies of the inefficiency in the financial system is they've built up a lot of debt, an unnecessary level of debt in the economy before the virus hit. And then you look around the world, and most countries' response to the virus is to have a big increase in government borrowing and fiscal deficits. The U.S. deficit, I think, is about 16% of GDP this year, which is really unprecedented. China's doing a little bit of fiscal stimulus, but they're really constrained because they had so much debt growing in the past. They've actually been quite restrained. Their stimulus is about 5% of GDP. So they're paying the price now for the fact that they had pretty lax financial policies for a long time.
Do you think there's the possibility of systemic risks in the financial sector, which may impact their ability to, be that global superpower later on?
Yeah, they're definitely a superpower already, but they're not nearly as powerful as the United States in terms of the overall economy or innovation or the military. So they still have aspiration to grow quite significantly. I do think this pandemic is really a challenge for them. My co-authors and I, the co-authors of China 2049, we argue that the reforms we talk about are more important now after this coronavirus. It's more important to reform the financial system for the reasons we just discussed. They also have this weakness in their safety net that's been revealed by the pandemic. They're going to have this rapidly aging population. They need to put more public resources into health and education. So I think the pandemic is a kind of wake-up call to actually do some of those reforms. Now, we have to wait and see. Does the leadership go in the right direction or does the leadership go in the wrong direction? Because we do see some trend around the world against globalization. And I think that's basically going to be a bad thing for all of us. So hopefully China will resist that anti-globalization trend and continue to open up.
But David, one of the issues about the pandemic is the necessity to keep everyone in their jobs, right? To keep unemployment low. And the Chinese government has always used the state-owned enterprises as a means to employ large numbers of people. And we do know some of these state-owned enterprises are almost zombie companies. So do you see reform there? Because it's a chicken and egg situation. And it is exactly these SOEs which have huge debts with the Chinese banks.
No, you're absolutely right. Most of the debt in the corporate sector is state-owned banks have lent money to state-owned enterprises. And they're not actually a particularly important part of the economy. So a lot of that is really pure waste. You know, meanwhile, most of their dynamism comes from the private sector, both the big flagship firms like Alibaba and Tencent. But more importantly, there are millions of medium-sized private companies in China. That's where most of the employment is generated. Most of the patents go to these private sector firms. So that's a real contradiction in China, that they're steering resources to these state enterprises, which are not particularly successful. And then by definition, they're starving resources from the more dynamic private sector. And I think they could get away with that for a while because they had so many things pushing their rapid growth. But now it's going to be a challenge for domestic reasons and international reasons. And I think that the cost of the inefficiencies is really going to be too much for them. So it's going to be really important issue whether or not they discipline the state enterprises and allow resources to get channeled to the private sector, or are they going to double down on the state enterprises, which could very well lead to some kind of financial crisis. Certainly, it's going to lead to a slowing of growth if they double down on the state enterprises.
And, you know, it, related to this state-owned enterprises in some way is the Belt Road Initiatives. I think very ambitious. It's supposed to be over, what, four continents, 76 countries. And when I look at the original plan, it does look like it's part of China's plan to export the excess capacity, especially coming from the SOEs, while gaining some form of political influence. So I call it the checkbook diplomacy. Now, how effective is this as part of to grow China's economy?
Well, I think you're right that the Belt and Road Initiative, partly it's an effort on China's part to make use of construction companies and steel mills and firms that make earth-moving equipment. It's giving them all business. That business is diminishing in China, and so it's kind of natural for them to be looking more for overseas markets. I don't think the scale of Belt and Road is as big as some of the news stories suggest. I think China's been lending about $50 billion a year all over the world. That's a significant amount of money. But you sometimes read stories about $1 trillion. I just don't see how that fits into their balance of payments, frankly. So I think it's not quite as big as press makes out, and it's probably going to have to be reined in a little bit in the wake of the pandemic. China's got these domestic challenges, and then probably more importantly, a lot of developing countries that have borrowed for the Belt and Road, they're now running into debt problems. Yeah, this is particularly acute in Africa. You've got quite a few countries having debt crises, and China's actually the biggest creditor. So China's probably going to have to write off some of these debts. And then going forward, it's going to be hard for these countries to borrow at the same rate. So I think Belt and Road will probably get reined in a little bit, but it'll still be a significant source of financing for countries that want to go down that road.
And I want to bring this conversation back to Malaysia because, you know, the Chinese are involved in mega infrastructure projects here, which are controversial in nature. And there's some discussion that these may be debt traps for us with limited transparency, you know. Some say they're almost like Trojan horses and a form of reverse colonialism. Should we be wary of these initiatives?
I think that it's a little extreme to talk about reverse colonialism or U.S. government officials use this phrase, debt trap diplomacy, suggested China's deliberately trying to get countries into a debt trap. I don't think there's any evidence of that. I think the Chinese, the lending institutions, China Exim Bank, China Development Bank, I think that they were a little bit careless and haven't really paid attention to the overall debt capacity of different countries. Plus this COVID shock, nobody expected this. So this is a genuine exogenous shock. And now we're going to have quite a few debt problems and the Chinese are going to need to write off quite a bit of debt. But I think they will do that. And people like to emphasize this one case in Sri Lanka where China took over a port. I don't think that's particularly important. It's a case where China financed a port that didn't really have much prospect. And the Sri Lankan government asked the Chinese to take it over and forgive the debt. I don't see it gives China any big advantage. But we haven't seen any other case like that. And while countries, particularly in Africa, countries have problems with debt servicing right now, I don't hear anything about discussions of the Chinese coming in. You know, they finance things like highways. They're not going to come in and take over the highways in African countries. I think that's not realistic. So I see it more as a learning process for both China and for developing countries about the risks of taking on too much debt and then, you know, what we need to do now that we're into this mess with the debt situation.
On The Breakfast Grill this morning, we have David Dollar, Senior Fellow at Brookings Institute, who was from 2009 to 2013, U.S. Treasury Economic and Financial Emissary to China based in Beijing. When we come back, U.S.-China relations and how does Malaysia avoid being collateral damage? BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to The Breakfast Grill. This morning we have David Dollar, Senior Fellow at Brookings Institute and co-author of the recently published book, China 2049, Economic Challenges of a Rising Global Power. Now, just a moment ago, we were discussing the rise of China, but also the challenges it faces to become a developed country by 2049. Now, David, we haven't quite discussed in detail the U.S.-China relations. I think it all started quite innocuously from U.S. imposing tariffs to some saying it's actually the new Cold War. The last one lasted 40 years, unfortunately. And, you know, but what does this mean actually for globalization? And will the benefits which we have seen, especially in Asia and emerging markets, will it be rolled back?
Well, I think the tariffs that the Trump administration has imposed, this is a pretty significant step backwards in globalization. First, it's not just China. Trump administration has imposed tariffs on quite a few other partners. But the big guns were aimed at China. Right now, about half of China's exports to the U.S. are taxed by the U.S. at 25%, which is a pretty significant level of protection. Now, this is not working out well for the United States at all. This was supposed to help with the trade balance, but it hasn't. Is what happens is the U.S. is importing less from China, but a lot of those imports have shifted over to countries like Vietnam, I know for sure, maybe Malaysia, Indonesia, Mexico. So the U.S. is importing more than ever before. And then this kind of trade war tends to cut down your exports. So the U.S. is having a very poor year in terms of exports. Beyond the effect of the COVID recession, the U.S. is really missing out on a lot of market opportunities. So there's a sense in the U.S. that the trade war is not working out for the U.S. But the administration is pretty committed to it. One aspect are the tariffs I just mentioned, but the U.S. is also taking aim at China's high-tech companies like Huawei and Tencent and Alibaba, ByteDance, which is the owner of the TikTok app. So the U.S. is imposing a lot of sanctions on Chinese high-tech companies for national security reasons. The way I see that policy, the administration keeps flip-flopping. Initially, it looked like it was going to kill TikTok, and then they just reached a deal where actually not much is going to change. So you do see quite a bit of flip-flopping. It's frankly bad for business. Both U.S. and Chinese companies don't like this uncertainty. It's probably one factor that's leading to the poor performance of the U.S. economy. But I suspect the U.S. is going to stick with some of this hostility toward the high-tech companies from China. But there's an active debate about the larger issue of tariffs. We have a key election coming up. I think if Joe Biden wins the election, I don't see him ending the trade war on day one, but I see him negotiating more practically with the Chinese. And that could very well lead to getting rid of the tariffs on the U.S. side and China opening up more markets and protecting intellectual property rights and reducing some of the subsidies to state enterprises. So I continue to be optimistic that the U.S. and China might find a way forward, but it's hard to be optimistic for the next 6 months or so, to be frank.
But if we look at the current situation, what has happened is that it seems very much, especially the smaller economic countries like Malaysia, Vietnam, or Indonesia, or even Singapore, we have kind of forced to almost choose sides between the America and China, especially in things like technology. So do we go with Huawei, for example, for 5G, or do we choose a non-Chinese player? How do we avoid having to choose sides and almost being like collateral damage?
Well, I think some decoupling in the technology area is inevitable. The U.S. is not going to let Huawei come in and supply equipment to the 5G network in the U.S., and many countries are taking the same attitude. So I'm hoping we can get to a realistic compromise. Yeah, there are a lot of areas that are closed off in the Chinese economy. Our social media companies like Facebook, Twitter, they can't operate in China at all. Google cannot operate in China at all. So the question is, can we agree that there's some high-tech areas where we're not going to have integration, but then allow most trade and investment and student exchanges and joint research? That, to me, the rational thing is to wall off a small number of high-tech areas with security implications, but then otherwise, let the economies be integrated. And I know that's difficult, but kind of bring it back to a country like Malaysia. My sense is you don't want to have to choose between dealing with China and dealing with the U.S. You would like to have economic relationships with both. China is going to be the fastest growing big economy for the foreseeable future. It'll eventually be the biggest economy. There's a lot of economic advantage for Vietnam, Malaysia, nearby countries to deal with China. So I think any effort on the part of the U.S. to try to isolate China is likely to fail. And the risk is we end up isolating the United States.
Now, I want to shift the conversation to the last chapter of your book, which is on China's evolving role in international economic institutions. And I think there's probably no disputing that there are some serious weaknesses in these economic institutions. But what kind of role do you see China eventually playing?
As I see it, China's a pretty good citizen in terms of participating in the World Trade Organization, the IMF, the World Bank. China has contributed a lot of money to the concessional window of the World Bank, which is used to help the poorest countries, mostly in Africa. China does a lot of financing in parallel with the IMF. So China's pretty deeply integrated with these institutions, but it usually doesn't get any credit for that. And China, in my view, is underrepresented in a sense. The IMF and the World Bank are both shareholding institutions. And given China's rise as an economy and a trading nation, China should have a bigger weight. But in recent years, the U.S. has opposed that. European countries, they might be a little bit more open in principle, but they're the ones who are going to lose shares. You know, if you actually look at the shares in the IMF compared to the world economy, the big distortion is that Europe is overrepresented. And it's not just China. India and developing countries in general are underrepresented. So we need to increase the weight of China and other developing countries over time. But there's a lot of resistance from the existing powers. And I think if we don't have a realistic approach to this, then it's going to be hard to keep the developing world committed to these institutions that were set up at the end of World War II. World Trade Organization is a little bit different. It's not a shareholding institution. Every one of the 150 plus countries, you know, has the same vote. But in terms of key decisions, countries like the U.S., big European countries, Japan, they do have more weight in practice. And I think we need to update the basic WTO agreement. There are new issues like cross-border data flows, subsidies to state enterprises, investment issues. It won't be easy, but if we don't update the WTO, it will become increasingly irrelevant. And I think for a medium-sized country like Malaysia, you'll discover a world without rules and laws is not a nice place for a medium-sized economy. I see the global system being most important for all the medium-sized and small countries around the world. And I think, you know, the U.S. has been a pretty good steward setting up a system where small and medium countries can prosper. And I have hope that we can get China to commit to reforming this kind of system. Because if we move to trading without this kind of rule-based system, trading and investment, then I think you're going to find the big countries really start pushing everybody else around.
On that note, thank you for your time today to help us take a long lens at China's economic growth and its challenges. Today on The Breakfast Grill was David Dollar, Senior Fellow at Brookings Institute, one of America's most widely followed and respected think tanks. I'm Wong Xiaoning, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.